We're going back to Mark 5, and if you recall where we left off last time, we're in the middle of a story in a story, a miracle in a miracle. And so we're going to read, and don't read them yet, but we're going to read 21 through 24, and then we're going to skip down to verse 35 and read through the end of the chapter. Now, just to remind you, what we see in 21 through 24 sets up our passage for today. But in the middle last time, we talked about the woman who had the malady, the issue of blood, that received her healing by coming to Jesus, grasping his coat, and being healed. And Jesus stops and deals with her and interacts with her and really addresses her more significant need, and that was just her restoration as a person and her entrance into the kingdom of heaven. We see that down in verse 34. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." When we look at that, it says made you well. Really, that could be translated has saved you. And I think there's a lot of reason to think that it's more than just her physical healing that Jesus is talking about, and one of those reasons is he addresses her as daughter. And that just doesn't happen anywhere else in his recorded interactions in the New Testament. So that's where we are. So what I would ask you to do, if you've got it, is read for us verses 21 through 24 and then skip down to 35, knowing that this other miracle was in the middle, so to speak, was the white cream and the Oreo cookie, if you want to think about it that way. So anyway, 21 through 24 out of chapter 5, and then 35 to 43.
And when Jesus was come over again by ship unto the other side, a great multitude gathered together to him. And he was near unto the sea, near by the sea. And behold, there came one of the rulers of the synagogue, whose name was Jairus. And when he saw him, he fell down at his feet, and besought him instantly, saying, "My little daughter lies at the point of death. I pray thee that thou wouldst come and lay thine hand on her, that she may be healed and live." Then he went with him, and a great multitude followed him and thronged him. 35. While he yet spake, there came from the same ruler of the synagogue's house certain which said, "Thy daughter is dead. Why diseasest thou the master any further?" Why you bother him any further? Is that all he wanted to do?
No, keep right on going to the end of the chapter.
End chapter, okay. As soon as Jesus heard that word spoken, he said unto the ruler of the synagogue, "Be not afraid, only believe." And he suffered no man to follow him save Peter and James and John, the brother of James. So he came into the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and saw the tumult, and them that wept and wailed greatly. And he went in and said unto them, "Why make ye this trouble and weep? The child is not dead, but sleepeth." And they laughed him to scorn. But he put them all out, and took the father and the mother of the child, and them that were with him, and entered in where the child lay, and took the child by the hand, and said unto her, Talitha kumi, which is by interpretation, "Maiden, I say unto thee, arise." And straightway the maiden arose and walked, for she was of the age of 12 years, and they were astonished out of the measure. And he charged them straitly that no man should know of it, and commanded to give her meat.
All right. So if we go back to the first of this, before we get involved with the woman that caught up with Jesus, and going back up there to 21, so they'd come back from Galilee, well, not back from Galilee, back from the other side of the Galilean Sea, and about 6 mile little trip, and as soon as they get out, they got this crowd there pressing in, and Jairus, an official of the synagogue, came up to him. Apparently, you can kind of tell he was urgency looking for him, fell at his feet, implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter's at the point of death. Please come and lay your hands on her so that she will get well and live." Probably a couple of comments ought to be said there. When he says at the point of death, I mean, that is, she is dying as we speak, not just terminally ill. I mean, this is the moment. This is the last opportunity to address this young lady while she is still alive. And even the language of it says it's probable that she's already died. I mean, it's that kind of a statement here in the timing of it, as it said. And even in the way many commentators would say, the way that the man responds says, come and lay your hands on her so that she'll get well and live, implies even if she's already dead. I mean, this is a strong statement of his faith in what Jesus could do, his belief in the level of Jesus' power over her physical need, including if she had died. And so Jesus went off with him. So he stops what he's doing. He heads out. Now at this point, the crowd is following en masse. They're pressing up on him. Crushing is the way the crowd's pushing on him is described. And so then he has this encounter with the lady who also had an illness, and she was seeking Jesus. And, you know, Jesus stops and you know, who touched me? You know, and if you were Jairus, depending upon your state of mind and your level of faith, you might be coming impatient at this point. I can't imagine anybody having a daughter, this level of illness, point of death, and here Jesus is stopping to say, who touched me? You know, it'd be kind of hard not to speak up, but potentially Jairus has enough sensibility to know, I've got him going in my direction, last thing I want to do now is offend him. So I don't know, we weren't there, nothing said, everything's guesswork, but if you just put yourself in Jairus' spot, I think that'd be really tough. And so he stops and he deals with this woman, he talks to her, and she tells him the whole story, Jesus, because Jesus says, you know, who touched me? And it says in here that the woman, fearing and trembling, aware of what had happened, fell down before him and told him the whole truth. So we got just a little glimpse of it earlier, what Mark said, that she had been suffering with this for 12 years. She'd been through doctors after doctors, the healing folks of the day. Not only no relief, but it was worse. And at this point now she's destitute because of the financial drain that this has been on her to try to deal with it. Now, we took a couple of sentences here. Mark is giving a summary. Who knows how long this took? And I can just see the tension building for Jairus. Now, maybe Jairus is a better man than I don't know. That's very probable. But I would be getting just a little bit bouncy about this point. You know, let's get on with this. And so, finally, Jesus says to her, and that's, I'm putting the words finally in there, and that's when he says, daughter, your faith has made you well, and really draws that moment with the woman to a close with this encouraging statement to her. And then verse 35, and while Jesus was still speaking. So this encounter is going on. I mean, there is not some minutes between the encounter with the lady and the time these messengers come up and find Jesus. I did read that some commentators say, well, we don't know what he was speaking about. He might have been talking with the crowd. I can't believe that. I mean, the way Mark writes this, and while he was still speaking, I mean, just everything about the flow of this says, no, it's while he's still speaking to the woman. Okay? And but anyway, they came from the house of the synagogue official saying, so here's a question. Did the people in the house know where Jairus was going? Sure they did. Jairus had announced before he left, which is a bold thing for him to do, considering his position and the enmity that's between the Jewish leaders and Jesus and all that. They knew where he was going, and they even knew why he was going. Why? Because while he was still speaking, these people came from the house of the official saying, your daughter has died. Why trouble the teacher anymore? Now, it's hard to understand motives or thoughts here. You could twist this into a motive that said these people were trying to extract Jairus from this politically unsound position he had taken to trust Jesus. I don't know. That's possible that they were just saying, here's our opportunity to get him out of this mess he's creating by involving Jesus, who's the enemy of the people that he's most closely associated with in his responsibilities in the synagogue. But it very likely could just be, it's over. There's no hope. We all need to just give up and move on. But they tell him, your daughter's died. Why trouble the teacher anymore? And it's interesting, Jesus' title here, almost certainly was the word rabbi. We're not given the Aramaic here, but teacher. So, you know, Jesus, we think of as what we've seen here in Mark, Jesus' primary relationship to the people would be healer, miracle worker, and these kinds of things. But the title that they use is teacher, which shows that Jesus has been preaching, right? He's telling them about the truth of the kingdom, and so clearly they understand his primary role is that of teacher. Yes, he's doing these other things, but his main emphasis is these teaching. Well, Jesus hears what they're saying, and he tells the synagogue official, don't be afraid any longer, only believe. Now, Jairus has shown a lot of faith already, hasn't he? And so here's Jesus hearing what they're saying, and he responds with, don't be afraid, believe. Let your fears go, replace your fears with faith, and follow that through. And that's a pretty kind thing to do. And you see Jesus never putting people to a challenged faith test, my words there. But when you look at Jesus in his ministry and he asks people, well, do you believe? You know, he even gets responses like, yes, Lord, I believe. Help me in my unbelief. And he doesn't go, well, do you really believe or not? I mean, there are many times Jesus could have challenged people's faith. But when Jesus sees a spark of faith, he's encouraging about it. And here he encourages Jairus. You came with faith. You had faith. Stay with the faith. Don't fear. Stay with the faith. And that's a very kind thing for Jesus to do. I mean, Jesus could have hung back and said, well, let's see what Jairus decides to do. You know, is he going to keep believing or is he going to give up on it now? And Jesus says, no, stay with your faith. And so that's what he tells him. No response mentioned, but stay with your faith. Only believe. Have no fear. And in verse 37 then, we see that Jesus changes the complexion of who's involved. Up to this point, he's got this crowd crushing him. He's got his own followers there with him. He's got Jairus. He's got this whole big group of people. But at that point, he stops. And the only people he let continue to go with him were Peter, James, John, and the brother of James. James and John, the brother of James. That's one guy. John, the brother of James. And so this is the Peter, James, and John that we often see as the three closest to Jesus. In the book of Mark, this is the first time we see him separate these three out to be involved in a more significant way than the rest. Now, there are other times that Jesus did this. One of them was when he went out to pray before he was arrested. Another time is when the transfiguration, he had separated the group down a little bit. And had these folks closer to him. And occasionally we'll also get Andrew involved, which is Peter's brother, right? But these three are the main ones, and if there's a fourth, then it's Andrew that gets included. And so Jesus is taking them along, and they're going to witness what happens. Any questions or comments so far? Okay. Pretty straightforward account of this miracle that Jesus did. So in verse 38, we come to the house of the synagogue official and realize, you know, there's been this death there. And Jesus saw, in the words of the New American Standard, a commotion and people loudly weeping and wailing. And this would be the norm. The funeral, the death, responses in the Middle East are much different than what we practice in the West. Our customs and theirs are just night and day apart. And you may have seen some of that on the television if you watched any of the funerals that go along with deaths in the Middle East. You know, they're usually carrying the coffin and they're just wailing and lots of noise, cacophony. It's not a somber, you know, if your kids acted like that in a funeral, what would you do?
Be quiet.
You know, that's enough. Stop it. This is not that kind of a moment. But in the Middle East then and now, that's not the case. What people did was express their grief with loudness. They wailed, they screamed, they shrieked. They were howling folks. And that was a part of, and still is today, a response to the death scene in the Middle East, at least at the time of the funeral. At this time, the custom was clear that as soon as the death occurred, the grieving, this loud cacophony, was to begin. Yes, sir.
I always wondered why they called it the Wailing Wall. So basically, that's the reason.
Well, the Wailing Wall is not because of someone's death. It's a similar kind of response, and of course, the wailing is about the fact they don't have a temple. And so the wailing is a prayer of that style to God, just wailing and grieving that they don't have their temple to worship in.
So, Rick, is it also, am I correct that sometimes there were those who were professional?
Yeah, I'm going to get into all of that here. There are three things that were absolutely expected at a death scene like this. And the first one is this very demonstrative grieving, and everybody's expected to be involved. And it wasn't just the noise. If you went into the home where this was occurring, it would be hugely disrespectful if you didn't tear your clothes. The tearing of the clothes is the big sign of grief in what we see in the writings of the Old Testament and New Testament period. I mean, they tore their clothes when they were upset. So when you go in, you're going to tear your clothes. To the point that people would change clothes before they went to this point because they didn't necessarily want to tear their best clothes. And clothes weren't as... I mean, if you had a change of clothes, you're doing okay in this era. So you didn't have clothes to waste. So so you would tear your clothes. If you were a relative, when you tore your clothes, it had to be right over your heart. If you were not a relative, it should be near your heart when you tear it, okay? That's just the way it was. As a matter of fact, in this era, if you go look at the Talmud, they had 39 regulations that you had to follow in tearing your clothes, okay? So, I've worked with people in the technical world where I've had others make comments that, you know, if there's a hard way and an easy way, that guy's always going to do it the hard way. Well, the Jews just took that to the max. I mean, how hard can you make it? We're going to rip our clothes. I mean, it is a sign you're going to do it, but it doesn't end there. You're going to wear those clothes for 30 days. Now, there are things you can do. You can loosely stitch it up, kind of like a very poor baseball style scene, so that, you know, you can keep some level of decorum as you go about your life for the next 30 days. It was permissible, and people did it. They would put their shirt on backwards or their tunic on backwards so the tear was behind them, not in front of them. But that's a part of the grieving, is you're going to wear those torn clothes for 30 days. Okay, so that's the first one. You got this very demonstrative, loud, wailing type grief that you're going to display if you go in the home. Anybody going in the home. The second thing was professional wailers were good at it, and they were there. And they knew how to set the right tone. And we're even going to probably see the reality that there are professional wailers here in how they respond to Jesus, but we'll get there in a minute. And so you would hire these people to come in and get the ball rolling. They were negative cheerleaders, if you will. I don't know if that's the right image to put on it, but they were there to get the ball rolling, and they were always there. And then you had flute players. That's the third thing you had to have. You had to have flute players. And the flute was a pretty common instrument in that era. And they may not have been metal flutes like we think of in the typical orchestra band arrangement situation we see today. I'd almost guarantee they weren't looking at how the ones that are made today are made. They may have been other kinds of things. A recorder might have been, what we would call a recorder today might very well have been a flute then. But that was the most common instrument. I mean, lots of people played the flute. But that didn't matter. You didn't have to be a good flute player. As a matter of fact, the requirement was you're going to blow despondent notes. They're not going to match. You're going to go in and you're just going to play notes that don't fit. It is not going to be a jam session where they're getting together and putting some good tunes together. This is intended to be notes that indicate things are wrong. And, you know, I've played in some bands and whatever, and that's not hard. But you can get there pretty easily, whether you want to or not. Now, the reason I say these always occurred, here are the requirements if you're the most poor. You know, even poor folks have funerals today, don't they? Well, in those days, that's true too. And there were some minimum requirements. The minimum requirement, if you're a poor person, was two flutes and one wailing woman. That's the minimum requirement. So you're going to have this everywhere. Now, in Jairus' case, you know, he is a leader of the synagogue. He's a person with influence. So he's going to have people flocking over to be part of the flute players and the professional wailers. They're going to be quick to respond, I'm guessing. That's conjecture on my personal part. But that's what's going to happen. So you can just begin to try to imagine you're in a person's home of influence. Jews were all about honor and shame. So if you're he would be shameful to be in his stature and not have quite a cacophony going on. I mean, you can imagine what it was like when Jesus, Peter, James, and John got to the house with Jairus in tow. Well, here's what happened. So here's Jesus, and entering in, he said to them. Now, the them is not Peter, James, and John, and Jairus. It's all these loud people out there. Why make a commotion and weep? The child has not died, but is asleep. Now, this is not in alignment with the expectations of a funeral, okay? And they began laughing at him. And the words here, that is clear, this is a disrespectful or a contemptuous laugh. I mean, you've heard those laughs, haven't you? I mean, you've seen them. You've been around. And so they're laughing at him. When we look over at the same account, we're not going to go over there, but when we look over at the parallel accounts, they're also credited with the words, the child is dead. So they're affirming back to Jesus, you don't know what you're talking about. They're laughing, they're making fun of him. And so verse 40, what did Jesus do? Well, it says, but putting them all out. Now, do you suppose after their contemptuous laugh, they were cooperative in going out? So what comes to my mind when I think about this, it's a little bit different because he didn't make as far as we know, it's not recorded, a whip of cords. But it reminds me of clearing the temple. I mean, if you go back and look at what was involved when Jesus cleared the temple from the money changers, I mean, he's got men there, their businesses. This is a major operation, a large group of people. They're highly motivated to do what they're doing because of greed and the profits they're making. And Jesus single-handedly, without any real trouble, clears out the temple. So there's something about Jesus' mannerisms and his way of doing business. When he decides to give those kinds of commands and directions, people follow them apparently fairly quickly. And so Jesus apparently put that kind of a situation on, because there's not a lot of words said here, but he put them all out. And so, I mean, they're all out. And so that's done. And they're no longer in the game. And so they're outside, and he takes the child's father and the mother and his own companions, which would be Peter, James, and John, right? And he entered the room where the child was. And so he goes into this deathbed scene where the child is. And they're all along. And, you know, it's not much said about his, about the child's mother here. You know, is she faithful or what? Who knows? But she's going along. And taking the child by the hand, he said to her, Talitha cum, which translated means, little girl, I say to you, get up. That's the way it's in the New American Standard. Now, what's really interesting here is Mark is the only one that gives us the Aramaic. Jesus would have done his ministry in Aramaic. I mean, when we see Jesus' recorded words, we're often going back to the Greek to see what did Jesus say. But in reality, that's already one translation. Because Jesus would walk around and speak and talk and work in Aramaic. When they wrote the New Testament, they would have written it in Greek, because that would have been the common language that was available. And so it was more useful that way to do that. But Mark here gave us the Aramaic. That's the Talitha cum. And he gives us a translation. But it's kind of interesting that his translation is really a translation. What do I mean by that? Really what it says is, little lamb, get up. Little lamb was a common term for a child. Like we would say kid. Hey, kid, get up. Well, little lamb was a very affectionate way of talking about a child. And so, I mean, he's really translated this. He's not only taken us from the Aramaic to the Greek, but he takes the Jewish idiom out of it and says, well, when he says little lamb, he really means little girl, okay? So little girl, get up. And immediately, the girl got up, began to walk, for she was 12 years old. And they were completely astounded. So let's back up and talk about the first part of verse 42 to begin with. In the first part of 42, immediately, think about Jesus' miracles. Here we go again with another miracle about the physical world, where the one who created this world says, I think I went a little different right here. And he tells this girl to get up. And if we went over and looked at the parallel accounts, and it said, and the life came back in her immediately. There was something missing that came back, and we know what's going on there, don't we? That's the soul. And, you know, we've got these accounts today that I think we ought to be extremely hesitant to put any stock in of any kind about people that died and came back and tell us stories about what it is. And you'll notice the girl didn't give any stories here about what she'd been through. But this one would have some legitimacy, wouldn't it? Her, this little girl, and Lazarus would be the only two that we ought to listen to on that account. Because they're the only two where the master of the universe said they're dead and now they're alive again. And if they wanted to tell stories, we might want to believe them. But the rest of them, I think you could throw out very quickly. But this one, the life comes back in her and she gets up and walks around. Now, if you think about the level of healing that we're talking about here, when Jairus came to hear, my little girl's at the point of death. That's where this account starts. This was not a well little girl that just all of a sudden, I mean, it's not some accident or something. She's ill. And to have this kind of a recovery is pretty remarkable. And when it says, and she began to walk, the word, I didn't write down the word. But the word means all over full of energy. This is we would probably say today, she began climbing the walls. I mean, this is a strong word about her activity. She's active. That's the point of her, she's a 12-year-old girl. She's instantly acting like an energetic 12-year-old girl. She's running around ready to go. What's next? You know, I'm ready for something to do. And so that's the kind of reaction we get, and that's why they were completely beside themselves. It wasn't just she's breathing again. She's herself again, and in a very positive, full of energy way. And the words there, they were completely astounded. It's the same words that you would use, that they did use when they talked about what the relatives of Jesus thought about him. He's beside himself. And so they were just dumbfounded, would be how we would say it, with what they saw. Okay? And so here we are, this girl's running around, and Jesus gets back in charge of the situation a little bit, and he gave them strict orders that no one should know about this. This is one of the few times in the New Testament where Jesus gives these strict orders, and there's no record given that they didn't follow them, in terms of don't tell anybody. Everywhere else it seems like, not 100% of the time, but often it's like, that was a waste of breath, Jesus, because they told everybody they could see as soon as they could see. Now, when I read this, my brain goes a little bit to, And so what do you want, Jesus? Do you want them to say when they go, well, how's your, you know, what happened with your daughter? Well, Jesus been here. She's fine now. I mean, what are they supposed to say? I mean, you had the funeral people there. You had the wailing. It had to have been news to some point in some part of the town already. As a matter of fact, if you go into the archaeological world of Christian archaeologists, they believe that they know where the synagogue was, and they know where this ruler's house was. And it's about a 6-minute walk from the shore to the house to the synagogue. I mean, it's really located centrally in the community. So the belief is that how could this not have been news? But I'm not trying to question what Jesus asked here. It's just, I imagine Jesus is going to let the mystery grow. Hey, you know what? That's none of your business. You know, I don't know what he expected them to say. But anyhow, don't tell anybody what just happened here. And then he gave them, he said, give her something to eat. And I think he's kind of pulling them out of their dumbfoundedness. Let's get life back to normal. She's been sick how long? I mean, she had to be to the point she needed something to eat, nourishment. And so that's where Jesus takes this, is don't talk to people. Give her something to eat. And then the next line, we're not going to cover it today, but in chapter 6, verse 1, and Jesus went out from there. So the full day Jesus has had is pretty phenomenal. He's been across the Sea of Galilee. He has dealt with this demoniac, been, in effect, asked to leave town, comes back across the sea, is greeted by a crowd on the shore that is anxious to be around him, crushing a level of presence of this crowd. Jairus comes. They head out to take care of Jairus' requests. In the meantime, he has the miracle of the woman who was ill on her own and stops, and they have all that encounter. And then he gets over here to Jairus' house and deals with this funeral and raises this young woman from death to life. And so it's been a pretty amazing full day for Jesus and for his disciples. And, you know, here's another interesting question, because one of the things that I saw in reading people's thoughts on, you know, why narrow it down to the four? Well, you know, obviously there wouldn't going to be room for a crowd to gather around for this, and Jesus knew who he wanted to see. And most folks say, well, you know, these three will go back and tell everybody else. You know, they're kind of be the spokesman and the conduit of information to the 12. And I'm not saying that didn't happen and that Jesus wouldn't even been okay with that. But look at what Jesus said. Don't tell anybody. I mean, I'm wondering, and that's all it is wondering. So did these three go back and tell the other nine what happened? Or did they go, sorry, we can't talk about that? Which wouldn't have been really particularly helpful relationally amongst the other nine, would it?
Nope.
You special guys, who do you think you are, can't talk about it? Of course, if Jesus turned around and said, no, that's what I told them, we're not going to talk about it, it might have been okay. But, you know, we just don't get involved to that level of detail in what Mark's telling. And it's probably a good thing to go back when we think about those kinds of questions that just come up reading a story like this. Go back to Mark 1:1, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And what we have seen out of Mark all the way through, his purposes in bringing us these events And the words of Jesus are clear. His purpose is to show the power of Christ in every arena that we can imagine that we as humans come in contact with. He's got power over the demonic world. He's got power over the physical world. He's got power over the healing world, over your bodies. He's got power now, for the first time seen in the book of Mark, over death itself. So when you're looking for a Messiah to address the problems of the fall, he's got it all. There is not an issue that comes out of the sin of man that by this point now in this story, he's demonstrated his power over all of it. Yes, sir.
I've got some books at home, the Revolutionary War sermons, the 1700, 1600, 1800 period, and these guys preach about everything. It doesn't matter what it is. God has control.
Yep. Well, and that's a good thing for us to keep in mind. I mean, when you listen to what's going on in the news today, if somebody were to say, and what's the common phrase, the world's going to hell in a handbasket, meaning the literal hell, maybe not a literal handbasket. And so everything's just crumbling and crashing and nothing's as it should be. That's just not so. Everything is exactly as it should be in the sense of God is working his plan and his order. There's just nothing out of control. We can become anxious about the political direction. You could become anxious if you wanted to about the environment. You could become anxious about a disease that's going around. I remember when AIDS was going around, it created a lot of anxiety. I was traveling with my family, and we were asking ourselves, we were headed, I don't remember where, but we were long distance out of town. Well, what do we do with the kids to make sure, is there something we need, like today everybody says, well, wash your hands, stops the spread of disease, right? Well, what do you do before AIDS was really understood better? How's this being transmitted? How do I protect my family from this? What do you do? And I remember being a little anxious about that. It doesn't last very long because it became clear pretty quickly that it was bloodborne, and so that's what you deal with. But, you can become anxious about anything you want to. You can become anxious about the specific events in your own immediate family. Here's an illness we didn't expect. Here's a death we didn't expect. Here's a whatever event in life we didn't expect. But when you get it all said and done, God's purposes are going to be done. And this was driven home to me reading the book of Daniel back when we went through that. The events that Daniel saw were so bad it made him sick. I said that a number of times in front of you, but this is God's way. These pangs of childbirth that Jesus talks about, this is God's way of ushering in his kingdom and truly separating the sheep from the goats. At some point, he's going to have gathered in his elect, and he's going to be ready to move on into the next era. And it might be interesting, some people say, well, if you take the common worldview today, well, you've got evolution, and you've got, we just kind of came to be, and then everything kind of has just floated along in small incremental changes. I'm sorry, you'd better go back and look at your history, because Jesus Christ was not a small incremental change in world history. A single being, we would know him both as man and God, came into the world and turned the world upside down. And there were still remnants of the old. There are still Jews that practice Judaism today, right? There were still remnants of the old. There was still a secular world. But from that point forward, the world changed. And unless you're in China, even our calendars are measured to some extent from the point of Jesus' birth. It changed the world. And we know that that's not the first or the last time that God is going to work in the world and change it and have a new era. I remember multiple times in recent years realizing that there are chapters in life. You're a kid, you do kid things. You grow up and you do some adolescent things that lead to, for most of us, marriage and a family, and you really do things differently then. That's another chapter. Oh, and then the kids grow up and do all kinds of things. Some of those good, some bad, but they move out. Another chapter. Oh, you reach a point where you go, you know, I thought I was going to work forever. That really wasn't a good plan, was it? I can't make that happen. So now there's another chapter. And so life has chapters. This world has chapters. We had one chapter at creation, another one at the flood, another one in the time of Abraham when God established the Jews as his chosen people, another chapter when Christ came. Been in that chapter a long time. We've got some more chapters coming, and the next chapters that come are much more significant. Much more significant in the positive if you're a part of the family of God, much more significant in the negative if you're not. But those chapters are coming. And they're described for us in the New Testament in particular, but also some minor descriptions in the Old Testament. And we ought to be excited about those chapters, but we ought not think that that chapter's not coming and that book of history isn't being written just as God wanted it to be. Now, can you be disappointed in some of the paths it's taking? Yeah, you should be. Jesus himself cried over the direction that Jerusalem took. So shedding some tears over some of the bad decisions and bad directions that we see in the world, we need not be embarrassed about that, but we should be embarrassed if we don't realize, but I know when it's all over, God's got his pulse on the finger on the pulse of the whole thing, and his purposes will be done. Anyway, I kind of digress from the plan here this morning to get there, but this is the situation that we see with Jesus. He's healed this young lady, and now they're going to move on. And Jesus has now demonstrated his power even over death. There's a, borrowed this from Dr. MacArthur. There's a Canadian scientist named G.B. Hardy. And I don't know exactly what era that he did this in, but he, as a non-believer, began a search for true religion. And he said, I only have two questions in my search. Question number one, has death been conquered? Because if it hasn't, I don't really think it's going to be much help to me. And number two, once I find a religion that fits that box, has it been conquered for me? Because even if this religion has seen death conquered, if it can't be applied to me, once again, I don't much care. And, of course, we can predict where that's going to take you. His own comments were, Jesus, in the Christian religion, is the only religious leader, meaning a key leader like Muhammad would be, who we can't go to his tomb and know he's buried there. So when I look at Christ, he conquered death. And when I look at what he taught, it applies to me. And he said, there's truth. And that's exactly what we're seeing here today. Jesus not only demonstrated that he conquered death, but the groundwork is being laid. So by the time we get to the end of Mark, we will see that if you desire to have that applied to you, it can be. If you want to run away from it and reject it, that's a possibility as well. But that conquering of death can apply to you. Now, it may not keep you from dying in this life, but it certainly can look at your eternity and see that this life is not the end. Go over to John 11, 25. John 11, 25.
Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live.
Jesus' own words about conquering death. Luke 7:22. Now, I'll go ahead and turn to that. I'm going to set the stage here. This is John's account of the disciples of John the Baptist sending word to Jesus, related to John the Baptist himself asking the question, Are you the Messiah, or should we be looking for another? And this is Jesus' response to John the Baptist's disciples. Luke 7:22.
And he answered them, "Go and tell John what you have seen and heard. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear. The dead are raised up, the poor have good news preached to them."
There is Jesus again saying, look at what you're seeing. If you want to know that I'm the Messiah, he mentioned the healings, and he mentioned the dead being raised, and he mentioned the poor receiving the teaching. They have the good news, the gospel preached to them. Go over to John 10:10. Many of you probably have this one memorized. John 10:10.
The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly.
Yeah, and that verse often gets twisted to mean something that it doesn't say. Because if we look at the words of Jesus, he even made the comment, they hated you, they hated me, they're going to hate you. You know, this isn't going to be an easy life. And some people try to twist that around to it, but Jesus came for the purpose that his followers would have life and an abundant life. And so Jesus is not about death. He mentioned the thief. The thief represents Satan, right? And that's what our adversary wants. He wants death. But Jesus said, I came to have life and have it abundantly. One more. Hebrews 2:14-15.
For as much then as the children are partakers of flesh and blood, he also himself likewise took part with them, that he might destroy through death him that had the power of death, that is, the devil, and that he might deliver all them which for fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage.
So the writer of the book of Hebrews is telling us, here's Jesus' role. He came and died so that by his death, the ruler of death, meaning Satan, would be put away, done away with, defeated, and that those that followed him then would not need fear death anymore. And that's the great wonderment of Jesus the Messiah. All the way through the Old Testament, we're looking for a Messiah, we're looking for a Messiah, we're looking for a Messiah. What were we looking for a Messiah for? Well, in the context of the Old Testament, when you're reading what God told the Messiah was to do, it was to come and to take care of the problem of the curse that came when sin came into the world. Now, it got twisted by the time Jesus showed up. They were looking for a political Messiah. They were looking for somebody that would make the Jews great again, rather than address mankind's problems with their own sin. But here's the Messiah, here to defeat death itself. And Jesus demonstrated that today. Questions or comments?
And we're still looking for the same solution.
We still think it's about politics when it's not.
But about people.
And we're there's nothing wrong with doing what we can. We ought to be salt and light to this world. Okay? So we need to be salt, we need to be light. Do you know the good news about the direction the world is going? We would say it's becoming darker and darker and darker in terms of truth, right?
Yeah.
Makes the light easier to see if you display it. And that doesn't mean that people are going to like the light. It doesn't mean that the world is going to be encouraged by the light. It doesn't mean that the world's going to respond to the light. But it makes it easier to be seen as the light. And so we have a tremendous opportunity in the midst of the great falsehoods that are being put out as truth today to show what the truth really is and where it comes from. And it's becoming much more contrasting. But any other questions or comments? Okay, well, let's close with a word of prayer. Father, you have demonstrated your power over our adversary Satan, over death itself, over every part of what we brought into this world through sin. Lord, there is nothing that we could have done, can do, or will ever do to play a role in overcoming the effects of sin in our lives. Lord, we do understand that you've called us to be part of your kingdom and to then to live like it and to be salt and light in this world. We thank you for calling us into your kingdom, for the assurance that gives us and the fear that is removed. Lord, let us move through this life without fear, quick to proclaim the truth and to do it effectively. Thank you for Jesus Christ. Jesus, we thank you for willingly laying your life down that we might live and live abundantly and live eternally. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.